This is a segment from The Annex, an academic sociology-themed podcast. For more, visit us on the web at theannexpodcast.com. And now we turn to Ju-Young Lee from the University of Toronto. Ju-Young is the author of Blowing Up, Rap Dreams in South Central with the University of Chicago Press, and he's now working on a new book, Ricochet, Gun Violence in Killadelphia. Ju-Young, I've seen you around social Twitter for a while, but this semester you were showing up in a ton of my information feeds. You're getting lots of media hits for the gun control debate in Canada.
Yeah, definitely. That's been a big thing that I've been involved in the last, I don't know, like 6 months or so. And it's sort
of— Can you set the stage for the American listeners who, you know, aren't following anything going on in Canada?
Sure. So this past summer in Toronto, there were a number of different high-profile homicide cases. There was a serial homicide case that's still kind of ongoing. It's in the trial phase now. There was a mass killing with a van attack where 10 people were killed by a person who identified as an incel. And then there was a very public mass shooting in this area that, which is sort of called Greektown, that historically has been a very family-friendly place where a lot of middle-class people hang out. And that got the news attention of, like, what's going on with guns, what's going on with violence up here in Toronto. So that's sort of like the background. And, you know, even though the rates of violence have gone up in the last year here in Toronto and Canada at large, you know, the country is still, relatively speaking, a very safe place, but there's been this anxiety about, you know, where are the guns coming from? And it's, you know, the federal government doesn't really have a good answer for that. There isn't a lot of data on this phenomenon. Mm-hmm. And so it started this really interesting conversation amongst politicians, amongst academics, amongst community activists about what can we do to make sure Canada doesn't, continue seeing an uptick in gun violence. Mm-hmm. And one of the more fascinating things that I think that has happened is that there's been different politicians like have been tossing around the idea of a federal handgun ban, which as an expat who now lives in Canada, I found that very interesting because this is not necessarily just a liberal position. This is the conservative mayor of Toronto, John Tory, has come out and said that he would support a citywide handgun ban in Toronto. And so that's kind of a bit of the background, I guess, is that there's been this uptick and now people are really talking and concerned about gun violence.
So what have the Canadians been asking you and what have you been telling them?
Well, I mean, one of the big things that they've been asking me is to think about is like, you know, what can we do? What's the evidence that, what are evidence-based solutions that help reduce gun violence? And quite predictably, there's been this tension. On one hand, there are politicians and people coming out saying, you know, the real problem is we need to get tough on crime. On the other hand, there are people who have come out and said that we have to really attack the root causes of gun violence. And so that requires looking at massive income disparities. It requires, you know, putting funding into public education, you know, everything from like better health care for vulnerable populations to mentoring programs. So what I've tried to do is I've really tried to, you know, provide a little bit of research context to the claims people are making. And I've come out and talked about why, you know, why we see shootings recurring in certain communities over and over again. Most of my commentary, I guess, has been trying to show the efficacy of policies that eliminate poverty, eliminate racism in the labor market, you know, the stuff that prevents young people from even going down the path of getting a firearm, from joining a gang, that kind of thing. So I've tried to really offer that perspective out and, you know, people have been pretty receptive to that.
You know, I just want to say I loved that a sociologist was sort of playing the role of pushing the policy towards evidence-based policy analysis. And it's like, I'm glad to see our discipline attached with that type of media. Sorry, Leslie, go on.
Yeah, I was going to say one of the things I was thinking about, and both listening to you, but also in reflecting on your social science and medicine piece from 2013 is, you know, I'm thinking about the Canada case and I'm like, well, number one, right, there, like the number of handguns and, you know, and firearms period in Canada is so minuscule compared to the US. I kind of feel like, you know, Canada does have a much better shot, I think, at, no pun intended, of actually of implementing a ban, right? Just because the numbers are so much smaller than they are here in the United States. I think that here in the US, I think many of us, even those of us who are, you know, who are anti-gun activists, or at least gun control activists, I should say, kind of feel like, you know, we feel like we're resolved in many ways and being like, you know what, there's no way we're going to get rid of handguns, right? Mm-hmm. So what do you do? And I was thinking, you know, if guns are here to stay, why don't we do what people did with the tobacco industry and just sue the gun industry, and whatever money you reap, that could actually be used as a fund to help victims of gun violence. I don't know.
I mean, I think there are lawsuits like that. But what is your sense of like handguns in Canada, like the comparison of how Canadians could tackle it versus what you saw here when you studied it in America?
Well, I think to go to Leslie's points, and these are just estimates, but you know, it's estimated that there are somewhere in the ballpark of, I think, let me just confirm this, 265 million guns in the US, which is absurd. I mean, that is, it's hard to even wrap your mind around that kind of volume of firearms. In Canada, I think the number is much closer to like 1.8 million. I'm kind of looking through my Wikipedia links, but yeah, so there's a huge disparity when it comes to that. And you know, in Canada, for those who don't know, in the US, Canada has, to get a gun in Canada is much like getting a driver's license. So you actually have to go through a safety training course. You have to, which is like a two-day course, you have to get a license that you renew every 5 years. On that license, you have to have people, you have to have references who will speak to your, you know, overall fitness to and responsibility to of owning a firearm. So there's quite a bit of common sense gun control checks in place to begin with. But I think, you know, people are really upset about year-to-date statistics here. And that's been another thing that I've tried to remind the media and people about, is that year-to-date stats are not really great indicators for how a city is doing, especially one that's growing quite a bit like Toronto. So I've tried to say that, you know, we need to think about rates instead of year-to-date stats. So, so some of it is really just sort of interpreting the data for, you know, lay audiences, and sort of some of it is also just sort of talking about what are some of the evidence-based policies that people have shown to work. You know, like one of the things that I've made a pitch for up here, which has been, you know, surprisingly well received among some, is that, you know, these interrupter programs where people from the community go in and talk to young people who are at risk of becoming involved in a shooting have been shown to have really good, you know, effects in terms of reducing violence. So, you know, I've made a pitch for these while other people have been, you know, arguing the real problem is that the police are not funded well enough, or that we need to get tougher on people who are, you know, arrested with drugs or firearms.
Okay, so let's talk about the project that you're working on now, Ricochet. First of all, I want to talk about your 2013 piece. And like, what a story. What an opener. We were talking about the small N issue in qualitative research last week with Rebecca Raby from Brock University. And the discussion was about like, how do qualitative researchers deal with, you know, complaints that like your N is too small or things like that. So I was thinking a lot about, you know, what qualitative people have to deal with when they're research is being questioned. And then I went to a, you know, a junior colleague's practice job talk. So I've been thinking about what makes for great quals. I've been thinking about the good quals that we've had on our our show as well. And one thing that I've walked away from all of this is, like, if you're a qualitative research, you got to tell stories that just open audiences' eyes to things that they otherwise wouldn't have seen, you know? And if you have a story that just blasts people out of their seats, nobody's going to care about your N, is my impression. And wow, what a way to kick off a paper. But it was like, I enjoyed the paper a lot, and I can totally see how it's going to resonate with Canadians. So do you want to tell us about your work in Philadelphia and then Ricochet, where it's going right now?
Sure. So so I came from a tradition where the idea behind doing ethnographic work was that your goal at the end of the day was to find a case study or examples or observations that reveal something new, that, that shed new light on a phenomenon. And so that could happen, you know, after interviewing 20 people, it could happen after 10 people, it could happen after following people. But the other part of me is also from a micro sociological tradition that doesn't see the N as the person, even though I wrote about it that way in that article, but I see the N as observing interactions. And so following one person over time, you're privy to, I don't know, a host, hundreds and hundreds of these interactions that you record in your field notes that you ask them about in your interviews. And so I think these days I kind of see the N of my studies being in the thousands in a sense, because I'm really chronicling different moments in the life course of different people. And so the N is not necessarily the person, it's really these different interactions. That's how I see it, at least. When I finished grad school, I was working on my first book, which is a book about aspiring rap artists in South Central LA. And one of the main guys that I was following around, who goes by the name of Flawless, got shot. And his experiences woke me up to the realities of people who survive shootings. The first thing I thought was that, you know, I didn't think that he was going to survive, but he ended up surviving. And then I realized that the vast majority of people who get shot are survivors. And then after that, I learned all about the different kinds of health effects of this, that Flawless faced, living with a colostomy bag, living with, you know, the bullet still in his body, like a number of different, you know, chronic issues that just really did damage to his own health and the health of other people around him. So that became kind of a question for me. It was sort of, what happens to other people? You know, how representative in some ways is Flawless's experience to those of others who get shot? So when I got to Philadelphia, I was in the Health and Society Scholars at Penn, and I had this idea, I want to, you know, interview other people. I want to follow them around who visit the trauma clinic at the hospital. I want to learn, like, what happens to people months, years after the after they've been shot. So I started by interviewing 40 gunshot victims in the outpatient trauma clinic. So these were people coming back sometimes weeks or even years after they had been shot. And after that, I would follow people around in their everyday lives to sort of understand, like, what are the ongoing challenges that they face living with these physical wounds and psychological wounds. And so that was really the basis for the project. And the project has now kind of evolved into a study of, you know, the title Ricochet is chosen on purpose. It's a metaphor for how the injury, the acute injury that a person suffers at the time of their shooting, ends up leading to a number of other effects in their lives that they can't anticipate at that time. So it leads to, you know, ongoing chronic health issues that, you know, happen after the fact. It leads to people losing their jobs. It leads to changing relationships with family members, with loved ones. It leads to changing relationships with the justice system. And so this one traumatic event has all of these ricocheting effects throughout their lives. And at the end, you know, the book kind of returns to the mission of, I think, a lot of the population health, public health work that I've been really into as of late, which is that how do we take this evidence, these observations, and turn it into some kind of intervention? And so the idea behind the book is really to show how much support people really need after they get out of the hospital, and that the long-term rehabilitative care options for a person who gets hit with a stray bullet, you know, walking home at night, are not very good. And it ends up leading to this very, horrendous reality where you're trying to find a clean colostomy bag because you can't afford to buy them. So that's sort of, I guess, a big picture story.
Yeah, when I think about the small end problem, right? I mean, I don't ever even associate it with qualitative work, right? Like, I think about it in terms of, okay, people who are maybe doing some kind of historical comparative work, mm-hmm. right? And, you know, whatever, and they got 20 nations in there. Totally. And they're trying to draw some kind of sort of generalizable, kind of conclusion. And I kind of feel like that's where small n comes in. Like, I don't even associate that kind of language with ethnographers, right? I don't know. It's kind of like, if I, tried to get, a pop singer to actually sing in the same key as a mezzo-soprano, right, who's been trained in this totally different way. I mean, I kind of feel like these are two, although they're associated, they're both empirical. Like, they strive to do two totally different things. And so taking that small n and applying it to ethnography, to me, it's kind of like, I was like, why would anybody ever do that? Okay. So reading your piece, like there were two things that, that it led me to think about. So number one, just thinking about the management of pain, right? Mm-hmm. In survivors of gun violence, right? Mm-hmm. And Paul, who's your informant, he happens to be a Black male, right? And, and I feel like every 3 or 4 years, like, we have yet another sort of public health publication or something in the New England Journal of Medicine by doctors about how, Black people just are, their pain management is not handled as well as it is for other groups of people, right? And so part of this, I was asking myself, well, how much of the way that it's set up happened, like, and Paul's experience, how much of it is because he's a Black male, right? Number one. And then number two, the other thing that I thought was interesting, especially when you're in your conclusions, in thinking about how, our healthcare system is like totally not set up to support people like Paul. Mm-hmm. But there are other programs, right? So there are these victims compensation assistance programs, right? Yep. Where, like, you would think that one of the ways that you could help to ensure that, that victims of gun violence, who don't happen to have health insurance, can get the kind of care that they would need. Like, there'd be like this greater integration, right? Especially in ERs where, like, look, like, this is something, that you can actually apply for, right? So it's this lack of integration. But even with these victim compensation programs, there are also racial disparities in terms of who is actually deemed a worthy victim, right? As someone who's worthy of compensation. Mm-hmm. So it's all messed up.
Yeah, totally. And the other thing that's really tricky about these victim compensation programs is that all of them, and they're all administered by states, require victims to, one, you can't have been committing a crime at the time when you were victimized. So
you have to be a worthy victim.
Exactly. Yeah. So that creates a kind of a difficult situation for people who get shot when they're selling drugs and who that becomes a wake-up call. And they say, wow, like, I never really thought it would be me. I want to get out of this life. But not having that option is a very difficult one for some people. The other thing is that it requires you to cooperate with police. And if they arrest somebody, it requires you to then go in and testify in court. Philadelphia right now, like many cities, has a very stiff anti-snitching culture. This is not like the old stop snitching code where if you were a drug dealer, a gang member, and you ratted out your homies that you were suddenly a snitch. This is now one where if people suspect that you're cooperating with the police in general, you can be deemed a snitch, and there can be repercussions for that. So some of the guys that I was following around would talk about this. They would say, you know, I really need that money, but I don't want to be known as the guy who snitched. I'd rather just take my chances. I'd rather just know that the person's probably still out there, and that I'd rather just not have that target on my back.
I mean, point well taken. Although it seems in the example of Paul, I mean, he did testify against his assailant, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It would seem to me that he would be like, he should be a perfect sort of candidate for this victims compensation fund assistance program. And so that's why, to me, I was just like, why didn't he get any of that compensation? Is it lack of knowledge? Is it this lack of cooperation between hospitals and the social workers there, right? And things like these compensation funds? Or is it that, you know, he might have gone through filling out all of the paperwork and still be not deemed worthy of getting funding from this.
Yeah, it was definitely much more of the latter, the last point. But, you know, Paul and for many of the other people who I followed, there's also just, so one story is a guy who had received like a summons letter to be interviewed for victims compensation. But at the time when he got shot, he was kind of moving around a lot. He was sort of living with his aunt, then also living with his girlfriend and her family for a while. And so some of this is just like the paperwork gets lost, and people's lives are such where, you know, when you're living through this trauma, you know, your attention to like these small things that help keep the ship sailing is diminished quite a bit, because so much of what you're doing is just trying to make it through the day. You know, a lot of these victims that I was following around would have trouble, you know, sleeping with the lights off and, you know, brushing their teeth because the vibrations would cause like the retained bullet to hit a nerve. So it seems sort of like very straightforward, but then I guess when I started following people around, I realized like, wow, these people are really dealing with a lot. And, you know, this is why some of those interventions that have worked really well are those hospital-based interventions. And they still have some at Penn for children who are victims of gun violence. But these are basically where a person is connected to a social worker once they're admitted into the hospital. And then that social worker helps them, that person and their family, navigate all of these different institutions and this paperwork that they have to go through.
I could see how this research would completely resonate with Canadians, because like it comes down to another one of those American horror stories, right? Where you're like, so what has been your, now that you're in Toronto, what's been your sense? Is it, is there, you know, is the Canadian system any different? Does it even matter?
Yeah, I mean, so it is a little different insofar as, you know, the universal healthcare here, people have access to, you know, a primary care doctor. They can go to a clinic, and that's covered by the province. But it's similar in some ways because people don't have access to the real long-term care that would help them get their lives back. Things like physio or physical rehabilitative care, they don't have access to necessarily counseling or psychotherapy. There are real strict limits around that, and so I think that there's a lot more in common, I should say, than there is that is different between the U.S. and Canada when it comes to long-term care.
Ultimately, you have to be rich or deserving in either country to get the full care that you need.
Yeah, I think that that's a pretty fair statement.
Yeah. So another question I have for you, Ju Young, I mean, and I don't know that you're that you're turning your gaze in this book to what's going on in Canada, or in Toronto specifically. But you know, if you are, then how are you doing that, and what are you finding? And if you aren't, just through your casual observations, like I'm sure as sociologists, it's really hard to just turn that off, right? Just because you're just going through everyday life. What are some of the things that you're noticing in Toronto, and how does it compare to, let's say, to the Philly case?
I'm not turning my gaze on Canada in this book, but I am working with colleagues on a longitudinal study where we're interviewing young people in marginalized neighborhoods across the city and trying to learn about their exposures to violence, their experiences with guns, their experiences with police. I think the main thing that I come away with is that there's a lot more in common than there is that there is different. And the main thing that I see is that in Canada, there is this tendency to kind of invoke this post-racial talk. A lot of people talk about how diverse, you know, Toronto is racially and ethnically. There's a lot of interesting data at the neighborhood level, for example, where some of the most marginalized neighborhoods in Toronto are also the most ethnically diverse, which is kind of is different than the kind of historical construct of the ghetto as we imagine it in the U.S.
It sounds like Queens.
Yeah. So there's this, you know, that there's this difference in terms of the neighborhood level, but what we're seeing quite often, and there was a report that came out yesterday that some colleagues were working on that showed that Black men are something like 20 times more likely to be shot by police than white men. The police don't collect this data on race, but the people who are ending up getting killed and injured in the city and elsewhere are overwhelmingly Indigenous and Black men. I see, you know, the main difference I see is that in Canada, there's a little bit more hesitancy to talk about race and racism. And I think that some of that starts from the fact that the government doesn't collect a lot of data on race. And they collect data on Indigenous outcomes, which is very important. And there are huge glaring disparities between Indigenous and non-Indigenous health, education, et cetera. But there's a hesitancy to really talk about Black outcomes and the experiences of Black Canadians. So I think my main thing in this project that we've been working on for the past few years is just seeing that, you know, the more things change, the more things stay the same. And I sort of feel like I came up here with this idea, this maybe kind of romantic idea of Canada, that Canada was the antidote to everything wrong in the U.S., But I now have this kind of view of Canada where it's like Canada is sort of like the U.S. light. Like same problems exist. They're just not as intense or as bad or as long here.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's – but I think one of the decisive differences is that there's government programs that are supposed to just blunt the impact of social problems. Like it's not like Canada has tons of problems. Mm-hmm. But I think the one thing that Americans don't do is they don't have government programs that sort of actively engage a lot of social problems, like with a, you know, productive approach. That'd be my impression. Mm-hmm. Maybe you disagree.
No, I agree. I mean, there are community programs here in the city of Toronto where, you know, they have like really nice, relatively nice facilities. They have music programs. They have things that, you know, a lot of the young people that I met when I was living in Los Angeles didn't have access to, that they would only get access to it because a person was, you know, running a community center on their own time. So right. I would agree with that. I think that, yeah, there's this complacency though that emerges in Canada sometimes when news reels come up about the U.S. and trauma and bad things happening in the U.S. And people here sort of say, wow, things are really messed up down there south of the border. And I'm glad that we're not like that. So I think that there's sort of this tendency to pat people pat themselves on the back saying like, wow, we don't have a mass shooting like that, or our president isn't saying crazy things. So there's a lot of that. But then I think what that does is it makes people complacent and they gloss over the inequality here.
I'm so guilty of that. I absolutely agree.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think, you know what I mean? I think that here in the US, we obviously have our own version of that too, right? And sometimes it's incredibly racialized. I mean, I remember, like I also did the Health Scholars Program, but I did it at the University of Michigan. Mm-hmm. And I remember like being in like a sporting goods store with my family, and my husband said, go over there and check out the Creel. And I was like, why do I want to check out a Creel? He's like, go check it out. And I opened it, and there was a flyer in there that said, what did it say? It said, crime is low in America, black crime is high, mm-hmm. right? And it was like this whole rationale about how it's not about guns, it's about black people, mm-hmm. right? And that's why Canada's crime rate is so much lower than ours here in the US, is because they have fewer black people. And I think, you know, I think in every single place where we see these kinds of social problems, there is, I mean, obviously this distancing or this sort of rationalizing away of why it is things aren't actually that bad, yeah. right? It's either because compared to this place, right, we're so much better, or it's compared to these people, right, who are the problem,
yeah.
right? Like, we don't have to be concerned about this. Mm-hmm.
My experience is that's 1,000% true. That a lot of white Americans feel like, my experience, and it's like anecdotal,
but it's small n.
Yeah, small n. But my experience is that absolutely white Americans, a lot of them think that social problems that are attributed to the country are isolated in black communities or minority communities, and that pulls the average down, but they're, you know, free of all of these pressures. Mm-hmm. All right, so one last thing, because we're sort of running long. In addition to your work on guns, I also saw that you wrote a series of really edifying tweets that resonated with a lot of colleagues, you know, about dealing with adversity in this business, mm-hmm. Things like that. And I thought they were terrific. Obviously, people loved them. Could you maybe share a little bit of, you know, what you were trying to tell people and,
Yeah, definitely.
Just pass it along to our listeners.
For sure. So I think, well, let me see. What was the inspiration? Well, there are many different inspirations, but the one that kind of drove me to start tweeting about this stuff was that I noticed that in our field, and when I was in the RWJ, I worked a lot with people in Faculty of Medicine, public health folks, people in the School of Nursing, and I was just amazed at how collaborative they were. Some of that might be built into the fact that they're, you know, applying together to get these, you know, NIH grants. So they're sort of collaborating. There's an incentive to collaborate. But I just noticed that there seemed to be a very supportive, collaborative environment. And I think sometimes in the social sciences, and probably more specifically in sociology, because I know that the best, there's a little bit, I don't know. It just feels that there are times where we could stand to be a little bit more supportive of each other. And it's something that's also reinforced by my practice. So I, aside from being an academic, I'm a martial artist. I teach Brazilian jiu-jitsu. And in jiu-jitsu, it's very much ingrained into you as you're training over the years that you trust your training partners. You're going to get better because you're going to help other people get better. And there's something really refreshing about that. And so I've tried to pass on these tweets that sort of help junior people out with stuff that I wish I would have had help with when I was coming up. Mm-hmm. And it's mm-hmm. stuff like how to deal with rejection when you get, you know, rejected from a journal, which is going to happen a lot. How to fight imposter syndrome when you're, you know, giving a job talk or when you find yourself on a faculty somewhere and, you know, you sort of feel like you're in over your head. And yeah, I mean, I've just in general, I think as a starting point, it's really about trying to generate positivity and supportive interactions in our field. I think that there are places online, I won't mention the place, but there are places online where the opposite is the case, where everybody's sort of like shitting on each other, and there's a lot of...
Well, there's like one particular cesspool. But you know, my impression after doing this podcast was that like 9 out of 10 people who I've met and like cold called, like I've never met you before, you know, I reached to you out of the blue and I've been doing this, are really awesome people. Mm-hmm. Like, I have to say my experience in meeting more people and putting more stuff out there is that, the community is really great. That's been my impression. It's just, I think there is one particular corner of our, you know, discussion that is really not edifying. It'd probably be best if people stop tuning into it.
Yeah. I mean, hey, I'm all for the, you know, apple pie in the sky, you know, type of view of how the discipline can move forward. But I mean, to your point, Joe, I think that, you know, we need to distinguish between people and whether or not people are good and whether or not those good people can also do some pretty shitty things. Well, right. And I think that, and I think a lot of the people who do these shitty things, like a part of it comes through their training, right? You know, and you come up in a department that's hyper competitive and your mentors are actually modeling for you that this is acceptable behavior. Then you're going to model that behavior. You're going to mimic that behavior. And so, you know, I think, to what you're saying and also directly to what Joo Young is saying, I think that, you know, hopefully, you know, younger, like more, you know, up and coming, established, but younger, this new generation of associate and full professors, I think will hopefully, you know what I mean, all come to this agreement that, you know what, this normalization of ugly behavior, and especially when it's anonymous, I think you know, we shouldn't tolerate it anymore.
But it's also like, do you think people stand in front of a room? You can stand in front of a room of 40 people and one person is tremendously insulting. And I remember when I was younger, I could walk away from that feeling like it was an utter failure with no idea that 39 other people listened and thought it was either boring or okay. You know what I mean? And negative feedback really sticks in our mind. And what's been interesting to me with the podcasting thing is that I've been looking at the analytics, like how often people click through and or listen to an entire episode, whatever. And I'm like, wow, you know, you get to see the people who you would be ignoring in favor of the one jerk. And my impression is, like, for at least for young people, one is I love what you put out there, Joo Young, because I think it's very edifying and we have to have more of that. But it's also just like, and I think you say this in some of the stuff you posted, like, don't get distracted by negative people. Like, they are definitely in the minority, even if the emotional impact of them is greater.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And one of the things I try to do, to go to Leslie's point about modeling behavior, is, you know, when I was teaching a graduate seminar, qualitative methods seminar a couple years ago, I noticed right away whenever we would discuss readings, these were students who are like in their first year of grad school. You know, that's a time filled with anxiety. You sort of are dealing with that imposter syndrome. People would sort of puff up their chests a lot, and we would discuss a reading and everybody wanted to have the brilliant takedown of said study. And I tried to pump the brakes on that. And I tried to say, so what I really want you to do is I want you to reflect on what are some of the things that this person or these people did well. And I tried to begin with that as a way to, you know, retrain them to sort of appreciate the difficulties of doing research, the interesting insights that they may have taken from a study. I don't know how successful I was, but I know that for those discussions, it did feel more generative and less about, well, this person didn't do this, this person didn't do that. It was much more about, you know, I think that there's really interesting stuff here that I could build on. So I really like that metaphor of like, I'm going to build on the stuff other people have done instead of I'm going to prove that they're wrong or they've ignored some things and their study sucks. You know,
Yeah, I'm not going to tear down in order to build, right? So.
For more, visit us on the web, theannexpodcast.com.